Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Tools of Songwriting podcast. I'm your host, Todd Murray. Today on the show, we've got my friend, Mitchell Evan. I've known Mitchell for around 2 years now. He's a Richmond, Virginia musician who plays solo in a band called Mitchell Evan and the Saboteurs. They have a really great sound, and they have a new record coming out very soon. So, Mitchell, how did you get started with writing songs?
I started writing songs when I was about 13, pretty much right when I picked up the guitar. I've been playing music since I was about, I don't know, 8 or 9, playing piano, but didn't really take to it like I did the guitar. And then as soon as I picked up the guitar, what I wanted to do is write songs. So that's what I started doing.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Can you run me through maybe your process for writing songs?
Yeah. My process, I guess, changes over time, as one would hope, and looks different today than it did a year ago, and hopefully than it will a year from now. But and it also varies from song to song, you know. But it usually starts with a lyrical phrase or a little melody line. I think a lot in terms of quotes and short phrases. Which can also be used as a title, you know. I think that's popular, and it's that format is used a lot in popular country music, where you'll start with a title and build a song around that, much like writing a joke, but starting with the punchline and then building the joke around that. So yeah, it usually comes about as spontaneous inspiration, you know. I'll just be doing something else around the house or, playing the guitar, and an idea will come to me, and it starts there.
Cool. Do you feel like you write every day or only when inspiration strikes?
Well, I've got two things to say to that. I think that there's like, you know, there's that quote that's been said so many times. I don't know who originally said it, but amateurs sit around waiting for inspiration while the rest of us just show up to work.
Yeah.
I believe in that. I believe in, you know, work ethic and prolificness as a prolificity. Crazy word. I don't know if that's right.
But
I believe those to be ethics, you know, ethics of an artist. Like, it's if I claim to be an artist and if I claim to be a songwriter, I have to work at my craft.
Yeah.
And I have to do that on a regular basis. That doesn't mean once a week when I have band rehearsals. That means daily when I have the time, you know. I would say 5 days a week, I'm writing a song or actively working on a new musical project or idea. And, you know, there's a day or two out of the week where I don't touch the guitar just because I'm too busy or something. But if I'm around and I have the time, I'm going to pick up the guitar. And most of the time when I go to an instrument, I'm actively working on a new song. So,
yeah, that's cool. I think the third episode of this show, I'd steal like a Stephen Pressfield quote that's like, I only write when inspiration strikes, and luckily, inspiration strikes at 9 o'clock every morning.
Right.
In other words, he just shows up every single day.
Sure.
Do you have any tips or tricks for getting good ideas out?
I don't know. If I did, I would tell you, but I wish that I could ask someone else that same question and get some tips and tools, but I think, like, to what we were just saying, you know, show up, put the pencil in your hand or put the pen in your hand.
You know?
You can just sit around for inspiration to strike, but that's a lot of time just sitting and waiting, you know, when you could just sit and pick up your pen instead and have a blank page. And I think that it's not a coincidence that inspiration strikes more when I'm at my desk.
Yeah.
You know, because I've turned on the channel and I'm ready to receive it.
Yeah.
You know, I think that, so the best advice I have to give is just to show up and try to write.
Cool. Do you feel like you ever experience writer's block at all?
Not really. I mean, I go through waves, periods of time of writing a lot, and then periods of time where I'm not writing as much, but I'm still writing. I think that this is a fair estimate. I said this the other day in a conversation similar to this, that I probably write a song a week. And so that's, you know, give or take 60 songs a year.
Yeah.
Which seems about right. Pretty much every time I go to make a record, I start with like 30 songs, narrow it down to a third of that. So, yeah.
Yeah, I remember seeing a lot of your B-sides on like, I don't know if you'd call them B-sides technically, but like on Bandcamp.
Yeah, unofficial releases.
Yeah, are those still up on the Bandcamp? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sweet. I think there's like 12 releases up there.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's songs from the Archives 1, songs from the Archives 2, Junk, which is 23 previously discarded demos, unreleased, that didn't make it on records.
That's cool.
Some of them are the scratch tracks of records, the first demo session. So that's how I go to make a record. I go into the studio and I demo. I basically clear my plate so that otherwise I'll go crazy and I get paranoid that I'm going to forget songs or that I'll lose them forever. Oh, yeah. And I am a bit of an archivist by nature. You know, I enjoy organization when it comes to my own writings. And and I try to, you know, I have a meticulously curated Google Docs. And it's, you know, there's hundreds of songs on there.
Yeah.
So
we'll stay with the writing process here. Can you tell me about the writing process for your song Cancel Out the Noise?
Oh, sure.
That was, my fiance just poked her head in the door and the dog, who was sleeping, just tried to kill her. She's coming
good
out now.
See ya. Cancel out the noise. Yeah, it gets interesting.
Speaking of noise.
Yeah, just cancel it out, you know. It's hard to do. It's easier said than done. I can't help the way I feel. Fades and copper, I've always got a choice. I can't cancel out the noise in my head. I don't want to be sad. Help me focus on the joy. It's interesting when you start asking about specific songs. You know, I think one of the most amazing things for me, so like the reason I know that I'm a songwriter and like that I'm supposed to be doing this type of work is because of the way that it makes me feel when I'm engaged in this type of work.
Yeah.
And the way that I have a physiological response to this type of work, you know, like I would say the most awake, the most alive and the happiest I feel, the most content in my life is when I am deep in the throes of a new song. That moment where you're in the third verse and you're on the second line and you're waiting, trying to get the third line, you know, where nothing else matters, nothing else exists but me and the page and the ideas and the words that flow in between the two, you know.
I can definitely relate to that, what you're talking about. That
yeah, it, like my whole brain lights up, you know, my whole brain, everything is engaged. And for me, that is the thrill of this whole thing. You know, people get asked that question often, what do you prefer most, writing in the studio or on the stage, you know, playing live? And for me, I love them all.
Yeah.
I feel most at home in the studio, I think, but I don't feel anywhere more home than at my desk alone.
Yeah.
You know, and the true thrill, the pinnacle of the whole experience is writing a new song. And the feeling of a brand new finished song.
Yeah.
You know?
For sure.
But what I was getting at was because everything is engaged and I'm so hyper aware in those moments of writing, I always, almost always remember exactly where I was when I wrote that song.
Yeah.
And I can go back, like, I'm Not a Monster, I wrote in Spain on a rock right on the ocean. you know, or right on the sea, and cancel out the noise. I was sitting in my brother's apartment. He was living in Oregon Hill at the time, and my brother was living there, and I think my parents came down, and actually, I think I was staying with him this weekend, visiting from Colorado.
Yeah.
And we were waiting to go out to dinner or something, and people are showering upstairs and getting ready and making coffee, and it's like 6 p.m., and I'm sitting on the little leather, what do you call it, an ottoman?
Yeah.
From a couch.
You know? I only know that because of my fiance.
And I remember all of that. You know, I remember what time of day it was. I remember what the ottoman felt like. I remember what guitar I was playing. Yeah. You know, and that wasn't even a song where I finished it in one sitting like I usually do, but because we had to go. You know, it started with those first four chords, and the I don't want to be mad. So yeah, it started there. I don't remember finishing the song. I don't think. I was living in Colorado at the time, and I was falling for someone new. I was I'd been single for 3 or 4 months, and I was dating around, and I met someone that I really liked, but I was very unsure about it, you know. I was uncertain if I should actively pursue this person, or if I should follow these feelings. She was younger, and there was a, you know, pretty good age difference between the two of us, which was one of my concerns, but, you know, it was the inevitable, and I did fall, and we wound up being together. So that song is about, canceling out the noise in your head, the voices that prevent you from doing things or tell you to do something in particular, and listening to your heart instead, I suppose.
Yeah.
And then, you know, wanting that person to, that special person to kind of console you and tell you that everything's going to be okay.
Yeah.
And it is about that, finding that one person that, that stills your heart, you know, and quiets your mind, and that moment when you're connecting with someone intimately, and just like writing a new song, nothing else exists.
Yeah, I think that just music in general, you know, hearing a song that you haven't heard in a while can take you right back to that place. So for like the aspiring singer-songwriters, like it's good for them to know that it's even more fulfilling when it's your own song, when it finally reaches that level of completion and you hear it like a year later and you're like, oh, I remember where I was at. Mm-hmm. I did this.
So, absolutely. It's extremely visceral and poignant, you know? Yeah. And, last night I said on stage that, you know, one of the beautiful things about being a songwriter is that I have a living testament of all the things that I've done, all the places I've been. And because those moments are so visceral when I'm writing a new one, it's burned into my memory, you know, and I can flip. I started recently making a book of my lyrics, and eventually I want to make chord charts and publish or at least print a few copies of the Mitchell Evans songbook, you know, of as many as I can do. And there's probably a few dozen in there right now. And, it's just in a binder, just printed out lyrics, you know.
That's cool.
And I bring them to gigs so I can play some of the old ones. And looking through that book and opening up to those songs is like looking at a photo album, going back in time to a different memory.
Well, you and I, we both lived in Colorado at different times. So why did you decide to move out there, and how do you think it influenced your writing?
Yeah, that's a good question. What years were you there?
2004, probably 2003 through 2008 or so.
Wow, I was like, when you were a kid.
Yeah.
With the family?
No, it was my second year of college.
Okay.
I guess I should talk into the mic. Yeah, it was my second year of college. I wanted to be a part of this national student exchange program. So I just picked I had an option. I was going to school in Kentucky, and I had to pick between Tennessee North Carolina, something else in Colorado, and the farthest one away is the one that picked me to go for a year. And then I just ended up staying there for, I guess, like 6 years.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And where did you live?
Greeley, mostly, and then a little bit in pretty much Denver.
I like Greeley. Like
a suburb.
I used to play at a couple breweries in Greeley. Really? Greeley smells like shit.
Yeah. It's,
the whole town smells like shit, dude.
Yeah, I'm surprised that
what's up with that?
That you said, well, it's complicated. It was it's like a meat packing plant. Like Swift Meat is there. And they would say that like on the blood burning days or something like that is when the town would smell the worst.
But, of course. So it's like a factory farm.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
God, that's terrible. No, but Fort Collins is cool, and Fort Collins is just like a rock skip away.
Yeah, you know? That was where I'd always go. Go towards the mountains and play in Loveland and Fort Collins, and I wish that I lived in Fort Collins.
I think Fort Collins is probably one of the most ideal towns I've ever been to in my life.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah. It's perfectly populated for its size.
Yeah.
It is so clean and gorgeous, and the weather's great, and they have... Did you ever go to the downtown artery?
Potentially. I used to play around there.
It was a multi-purpose art space that had a concert venue that was kind of like the Broadberry, but a smaller room.
Yeah.
But like a big stage like that. And, it was a coffee shop in the front, also a winery. They had a recording studio and an art gallery. It was so badass. I mean, places like this don't exist in most communities, and it's like... so good for a community. We played a couple of awesome shows there. Roger Klein and the Peacemakers. And Colorado's cool, man. I can't wait to go back. I miss it. I lived there for 4 years. But I moved out there in 2014. I just dropped out of college. Okay. I'd failed out of college in Pennsylvania. And I went home to live with my parents for a while. And part of the reason I failed out of college is because I was more interested in drugs and women and all that stuff in school at the time. I wasn't really capable of doing it, to be honest. I think towards the end I was skipping class more than I was going, you know. Just incapable of living on my own successfully and disengaged in school. And I think it was inevitable, you know. I didn't have the courage when I was 18 to say, hey, look, I don't want to go to college to my family and friends and peers. And the pressure is really overwhelming, you know, for someone who's 16, 17, deciding if they want to go to college and that they're told the that they have a year to figure out what they want to do with the rest of their life. And the truth is most people don't know. I think if you don't know, the smartest thing you could do is not go to school right away.
Yeah.
But I didn't know what else I would do if I didn't go to school, so I went, you know. I also wasn't confident enough as a songwriter. I knew that I wanted to be a songwriter and I wanted to play music for a living. I always knew that since I was 14, you know. But I didn't have the confidence or the courage to say that. And so I wasted a bunch of my parents' money in 2 years, and I met a girl there, and she followed me out to Colorado. But long story short, I went home to live with my parents after I failed out of school, and I was struggling with substance abuse at the time that had been going on since high school, all through college. You know, it was just drug fueled 2 years, and even taking drugs I don't like, you know.
Yeah.
And I had an incident like 2 weeks after I was living with my parents back in Virginia, after I moved back, where I took too much and had an overdose and woke up in the hospital. And then it happened again like a week later, you know. And then they were like, my parents were like, you know, you can't do this and live here anymore. So it's either go get help or pack your bags. And I knew that I wasn't capable of living on my own in the state that I was in, taking care of myself. And I knew that there was no future in what I was doing. So I, you know, threw my hands up and went along with it, and it stuck. I was really lucky that it stuck. Most 20-year-olds in rehab, have a hard time, I think. Yeah. I turned 20 years old in rehab, and like my parents brought me a new skateboard on my birthday, but it was a great place and I learned a lot and it saved my life at the time. I was definitely going to destroy myself and had already been doing that for a while. So after I got out of rehab, which was in Williamsburg, we were looking for aftercare, step down situation. So we found one in Colorado. They said, where do you want to live? Where do you want to live? Pick a place. It's like going to college. You can go anywhere in the country. We'll find you a program. And they were trying to send me to Florida. They sent a lot of people to Delray, Florida. And there are these communities in Florida that are recovery communities. So rehabs from all over the country send these newly sober people to these communities. And that's like what it is. Hmm. It's just sober livings. And then right outside of those little neighborhoods, there's the hood where you can buy drugs, like it's become this this whole thing. But I didn't really know that at the time, and all I knew was these two or three guys that became my best friends in rehab were going there, so I wanted to go. And then I rethought it through and realized I don't really like Florida, and I didn't want to be there. And I knew I'd been to Colorado and I liked it there, and I liked snowboarding and I liked the mountains. And my friend Daniel was going to school at UC Boulder at the time, and I'd been out there to visit him. So I said Colorado, and we found this place called Choice House, which is a sober living house in Louisville, Colorado, just outside of Boulder. Louisville and Lafayette are the suburbs.
Yeah, it kind of.
And there's Broomfield and Westminster. This is in between Boulder and Denver.
Okay.
Yeah. So Longmont, all those areas.
Yeah, I remember Longmont.
So Longmont's towards you. It's going north from Boulder towards Greeley and Fort Collins.
Yeah.
And I lived in that sober living house for 9 months. It was three houses in a neighborhood. It didn't look like a facility. You wouldn't know what it was. If you drove by it, you just think it was houses, because it was. It was three nice homes in a suburban neighborhood in Louisville. And there was like 12 to 15 guys between the three houses at any given time. So like some of the houses were divided into apartment units. So there was like, I don't know, five people in each house or something like that. And it was a great time for me. I mean, I worked a lot of different jobs, some that I hated. I did landscaping. I bussed tables and washed dishes for like a year. Shitty stuff, and then I got a job at a coffee shop, and I did that for 3 years out there, and worked at a grocery store. Did a lot of different things, stayed sober. Got really involved in the recovery community out there, and it greatly impacted my songwriting. I mean, invaluable, Yeah. I look at Colorado like that was my musical education. I went to Colorado as an amateur, and I left a professional, It was like going to college for my craft, because I made it that way, because I wanted to, and I was sober. And there was nothing in the way of me achieving what I wanted, because I was finally out of my own way, because I had been, engaging in self-destruction since I hit puberty, really. And for the first time in my life, I could function and function pretty highly, and make good decisions, and be trusted and save money and do, I could be an adult. And it was a lot as a 20-year-old, 20 years old, brand freshly sober, 2,000 miles away from my whole family.
Yeah.
On my own and not going to school, you know, it's like, it's kind of a weird experience. I didn't know anyone except for my friend in at UC Boulder there. Mm-hmm. And we didn't even really see each other much when I was out there. But so after the sober living house, I found a house that we could rent as an apartment. And my dad became the landlord. And we filtered guys from the sober house into the house, which was hard at first because people are a toss-up at that level in recovery.
Yeah.
The statistics are very much against us. And, you know, I would say 80% of people don't make it a year after treatment, which is sad, you know, but it's that's the nature of this affliction. And so, yeah, I lived in that house with my girlfriend at the time, Emily, who followed me out there from Pennsylvania. She's a Lancaster, PA girl. And we eventually found the right group of guys to live with us, people that were reliable. And two of them were in recovery, two of them weren't. And I just worked at those different jobs and played a lot of music. And as soon as I got there, even when I was in the sober living house, like I was booking gigs, you know, and I started playing my first solo gigs. Like I had done a few before, but this was the first time I was like actively pursuing my own songs.
Yeah.
And I mean, I grew up playing in bands. Like I was in three different bands before I graduated high school, all for a couple of years. So they're substantial learning experiences for me. And I knew how to perform and play with other people. But I had never played under my own name.
Mm-hmm.
So when I moved to Colorado, I took my first name and my middle name and began performing as Mitchell Evan. And I still at the sober house. I had only been in Colorado for 6 months when I was contacted by Lance Bendixson, who is a producer out there, older guy in his 60s. Mm-hmm. You know, he worked with The Fray on their breakout album.
That's cool.
He like co-produced that record, which is a huge deal. You know, I mean, that's like probably a platinum record. And he worked with like Sarah McLachlan and, you know, other stuff. But I was contacted by him and he liked what he had heard of mine that was on the internet, which is surprising because that's what I recorded in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't all that bad, you know, but anyways, we started working together and he made me take my music really seriously. You know, and I'm thankful to him for that because it got me excited and it wasn't cheap. You know, my dad was, I was paying rent and working a lot and totally taking care of my lifestyle. But my father offered to support this relationship with Lance, working together. So I would go over there once a week and we would like do pre-production working on songs and then production. Like we started demoing songs at his home studio and then we would find a studio and we'd go in and make a record. And like, it was cool, you know, for a 20-year-old, I think I needed it and I didn't need it, but it was helpful to me, you know? And I would not be able to participate in a relationship like that today.
Yeah.
I don't believe unless the person was a legitimate mentor to me. Lance was not, but he did have some valuable opinions, you know, and he cared for me, you know, and it was a positive relationship. There were times where I felt like, you know, why am I spending this much money to work with this dude? But the proof is in the pudding and the recordings are fantastic. They're great. And he worked at a high level, you know, and anyone he brought onto the team was doing their job and doing it well. And so like for the first time in my life, I wasn't doing home recordings. I was working in big studios with people who knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
And we flew to Nashville and drove down to Muscle Shoals, Alabama to record at the Fame studio with the Swampers. Like, you know,
that's cool.
Yeah. David Hood, you know, Drive By Truckers.
Yeah, it's his dad. Right?
Yeah. David Hood played bass on
That's cool.
on A Place of Love, my first EP as Mitchell Evan. And, you know, it's pretty cool, man. I mean, Spooner Oldham, who played like organ B3 on those Aretha Franklin records and like, you know, Percy Sludge and stuff. He's on there. He's like, God, I don't know, 75 years old. But we had a young drummer, and it was a hell of a time, man. I went in with, we actually did a lot. We did 4 songs for Place of Love and did the basic rhythm tracks for 4 others, you know, and some of those made it to Back and Forth, the full-length record. So by the time I was done, I worked with Lance for about 3 years, and by the time we were done, we had put out 2 EPs and a full-length record. And, I mean, it's like top-quality production, you know? And, yeah, so I learned a lot, like, so much.
Yeah, that's a cool journey.
Yeah.
Just from where you started to where that ended up. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I was lucky. I wasn't on the street, man.
Let's see here.
Being in a studio in Alabama is a lot better than sleeping in the gutter. I'm glad I chose that rap, yeah. You know?
What about your song, Let Me Down Easy? Can you tell me about the... I actually covered that a couple of months ago on Instagram.
You covered it?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't... Yeah, I did watch it. That's right. That's right.
What about the writing process? I think so, yeah.
I got to go back and listen to
IGTV.
It. Okay, cool. I did. I watched it that one time.
What about the writing process for that one?
That's a good one. Good one to talk about, I mean. But I guess it's a pretty good song, I think. it's decent. You know, it's a little long. I could have shortened it. But it's a good alt-rock jammer, you know?
Why must you suffer? Why must I watch? Why me, my brother? But then why not? A dance with the devil ain't enough. But to dance with you, girl, don't make me blush. I don't come around here for broken hearts. I spend my days just laying mortar. Some kind of foundation make me whole again, yeah. Make me whole. Make me whole again.
That song... Surprisingly, I don't remember where I was when I wrote this one. I was probably at the farmhouse in Colorado. Or, I mean, in Virginia, sorry. Yeah, when I came back from Colorado, I lived in Virginia for like 6 months with my parents, I think. And then I moved into, this was 2 years ago, and then I moved into a farmhouse in Goochland out in the country. And I probably wrote it there, but... It just started with that rhythm. Which is a cool rhythm. It's one I haven't used since then or on any other song. The bum, 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 bum. So it started with that. And, you know, it could have been one of those where the chorus came first. I feel like it probably was. Because I had kind of like fit that into the rest of the song. And I remember once I started writing the verses, I was confused about the chorus. Like, let me down easy. What does that mean?
Yeah.
You know, I had those words and I knew the chorus wanted to be those words, you know?
Yeah.
That's why I think it started there. And, so I had to figure out the connection in my head. And sometimes the connection does exist in the words on the page. But you just don't, I just don't know what it is yet, you know? And so, like, at first, there's 2 verses. Well, I guess there's 3 verses. The first 2 are before the first chorus, and then there's a second verse, and, you know.
Yeah.
And I had to rewrite the third verse because it was one of those where I call them like muse givings, you know, where you just get something from the muse and you put it on paper and you don't even think twice about it. And you're like, this is gold, you know? Right. And it was probably good writing and it was probably poetic, but it wasn't sophisticated enough. It wasn't as in like the information wasn't there.
Yeah.
It was pretty, but it was like, you know, what am I talking about here? So I rewrote it and it didn't even need to be done, I don't think, but it improved the song and I like this new verse a lot more. And as by rewriting that verse, I really figured out what the song was about because I was confronted with the fact that this song had been all muse givings up until that point and that I didn't, you know, put in the work to unravel it and to explain itself, you know?
Yeah.
And the third verse did that for me. So I realized that it was about, it's about being disappointed and being let down by life, you know, being really hurt and being scared and struggling to cope with, you know, heavy information and just wanting, if tragedy has to strike, you know, could you at least deliver the blows softly,
right?
You know, and you know, let me grapple with it over time, you know. And that's what it was. I was, I remember when I moved back, I was like, I felt like if as long as I don't make any sudden movements, everything's gonna be okay.
Yeah,
you know. But I was just holding on.
Right. Yeah, I like that. All right, last couple questions here.
Okay.
What song do you wish you had written? Everyone hates this question thus far.
The first one that came to mind right now is the Coconut Song by Gillian Welch. It's by David Rawlings. Money is the meat in the coconut. Money is the meat in the coconut. Yeah. Money is the meat in the coconut. Money is the milk in the jug. I wish I wrote that.
That's a good one. That's a good choice.
And maybe Birmingham or It's Money That I Love by Randy Newman. Or any Randy Newman song.
Yeah. I'm not well versed in Randy.
Oh my God,
Todd. I know Tyler loves him also.
Tyler Meacham?
Yeah.
Todd, you got to go down the rabbit hole, man. Well, I'll send you one record. Can I do that?
Sure.
Because he has like 50 records. Did you know that? I'm not exaggerating.
Yeah, I don't really know a whole lot about him. Toy Story.
I don't think anyone has more music than Randy Newman. He's like done soundtracks for like 30 movies.
Yeah.
And then he has like 20 solo records. It's incredible.
That's cool.
Or maybe like a Loudon Wainwright III song.
Oh, yeah. I know Loudon, for sure. Let's see here. What are your thoughts on borrowing from other writers? What are your rules?
Necessity.
Okay.
It's, you know, if you pretend like you don't, you're kidding yourself or there's no way you can generate quality material.
Yeah.
It's just like I don't live in a vacuum. Our experience is inherently borrowed, you know? We live on streets that were paved by someone else, you know. We move into houses that were owned by other people. We listen to things that were made by other people. And, you know, so like my music is a byproduct of both my experience and the things that have inspired me, you know.
Yeah.
And just like we have like everyone on Spotify has like their own playlist, right? There's nothing unique about that playlist. It's just your personal taste. But if you made a playlist of, you know, 100 songs, it would probably be different than anyone else's out there, perhaps, you know, especially if you're listening to like original, you know, underground stuff or something. And it's that unique blend of influences that become your work.
Yeah.
You know? So, like, I mean, I think if you like the blues, you have to be okay with borrowing.
Right.
Because that's a form of music that is a template.
Yeah.
It's like if you had, it's like, okay, what shape am I going to pour my paint into, mm-hmm. you know? And like the 12 bar or the 16 bar blues is a template for that.
Yeah.
And so now it's just, throw in a little riff or, you know, go back to this section or like insert music and lyrics here on top of this already established thing. So much of music is like that, you know?
Yeah.
And country music and folk music, all popular music is like that, you know? So I had a long conversation with Jonathan Facca about this, mm-hmm. Like last week. I do aim to be original, you know? I think original is an ethic as well. Originality mm-hmm. is a value, you know, that and an ethic that I hold in high esteem, you know, for myself as an artist. But it's not the most important thing. And I don't try to concern myself with it or become obsessed with it, you know? Because I think if you spend too much energy obsessing over being original, you're probably just going to make music that's perhaps meticulous and inaccessible.
Yeah.
Because it is overthought. And, you know, I think originality comes from honesty. And if I concern myself primarily with, is my art honest, then I think it will inherently be original because of that playlist I mentioned and because yeah. our lives are colored so differently than anyone else's, you know? And my experience, if I include the details of my experience, it will look different. Those objects will be different. And therefore the songs will be different because my experience is just like everyone else's, you know, I'm working with the same set of emotions. Mm-hmm. I have the same fears and anxieties. But it's the specific details that look different in my life. And if I include those, it'll be original. So yeah, I think that if executed properly, originality is a byproduct of honesty and, I try not to get that confused.
Yeah, that's a good answer. All right, man. Well, thanks for hanging out today.
Yeah, and answering all these questions. Thanks for having me, man.
Of course.
All right, folks. Thanks for listening, and I hope this helps you out. If you like what you heard, head over to toolsofsongwriting.com and sign up for the email list. See you next time on the Tools of Songwriting.
Million miles left to go.